Welcome to Protecting Project Pulp, part of the District of Wonders Network, featuring Starship Sofa, Tales to Terrify, and Crime City Central. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours.
This is Protecting Project Pulp, episode 56. I'm your host, Simon Hildebrandt. Welcome to the show. This week we bring you Rose Face by H.A. Lamb, narrated by Lewis Morgan. Born on September 1st, 1892, in Alpine, New Jersey, Harold Elbert Lamb was an American author of historical and pulp works. He's considered to be a strong influence of Robert E. Howard and produced both sci-fi and fantasy works for magazines like Adventure, Argosy, All Story, Collier's, Short Stories, and the Saturday Evening Post, while writing biographies of historical figures like Alexander, Babur, Charlemagne, Cyrus the Great, Genghis Khan, and Hannibal. He once described why he wrote about Asian history and people in this way. It all comes out of an intense irritation over the fact that all history seems to draw a north-south line across Europe through Berlin and Venice, say. Everything was supposed to have happened west of that line, nothing to the east. Ridiculous, of course. The financial success of his writing allowed him to travel widely up until his death on April 9th, 1962. Our narrator, Lewis Morgan, lives in Hamilton, New Zealand, and works as a professional storyteller. He's travelled the length and breadth of New Zealand for 20 years now, enthralling children with his own original tales. Find out more about that at zibong.com. When not on the road, he lives on his farm with an assortment of sheep and chickens, tending a rambling garden and riding the mountain bike tracks that crisscross his paddocks. So prepare to make your salams to Rose Face by H.A. Lamb, narrated by Lewis Morgan.
My master and Johnny Big, the Uzbek, had been at drawn swords. Johnny Beg had built a tower of the skulls of my master's retainers that he had slain. On the other hand, Sherzad Mir, who was my master, had taken prisoner the son of Johnny Beg, who was called Syed Afzal, the dreamer and eater of opium and bahan. Verily, it is written that the clashing of bright swords delights the soul of a brave man. Yet in this year, early in the 17th century of the Christian calendar, Johnny Beg put aside the sword. He took up another weapon. He called upon Krishna Taya, a girl of the Rajputs. This was because we, the hillmen of Badakhshan, led by Sherzad Mir and the English merchant Sir Wayand, had taken the citadel of Badakhshan. It was by a trick, but nonetheless, we sat securely behind the high walls of Kanjut and ate of the stores Johnny Beg had gathered there for himself, and we were content. He could not take Kanjut by storm. No man has done that since the citadel was built under the white peaks of Koh-i Baba at the mouth of the pass that leads to Hindustan. So Johnny Beg, who was a man of guile, thought that he also would play a trick. And for this, he chose Krishna Taya. He whispered an evil thing in the tiny ear of the girl, and she listened. Since the memory of our fathers, woman has played a part of treachery, and her beauty has made blind the eyes of warriors. Aye, it is so. I, Abdul Dost, the Mansab Dar, have seen it. And I watched the coming of Krishna Taya and hearkened to her soft words, which were as artless as those of a child. Too late, I saw what was in her heart. She was the one Sir Wayand named Rose Face. She was no taller than the armpit of my male shirt, and no bigger around than two small shields joined together. She was not a common courtesan, for she was of the Rajputs, who hold honour higher than life. Nevertheless, what is written is true. The face of a fair woman holds a spell. I saw it all. It could not have happened had we and our men not been idle and conjured after many labours. We had starved and grown lean in the hills. Now we ate and slept. At such a time, a warrior grows sluggish and its wits become dull, and the sight of a shapely woman is not unwelcome. This is the tale. There will be few to tell it, for many in Kanjut died quickly and went to paradise or to the devil after the coming of Krishnataya. The days had become still, and the warmth of the sun tranquil, as autumn spread its arms over the hills of Badakhshan. The sheep from the hills were pasturing in the valley as Jani Beg and his camp at Bulk sought out the tent of Krishnataya. I was not there to see it, but I heard much from one of the eunuchs of Syed Afzal, and more came to my ears from a woman of the Uzbek harem. Krishnataya was no better than a slave. Syed Afzal had seen her when he was with the Mughal, and Jahangir, the Mughal, had carried her off to please the prince, since Syed Afzal's father was Jani Beg, who commanded 12,000 swords and twice that number of horses. She was playing with pigeons in a pear garden when they took her. She had come from the Rajputs, and there she had been a free woman and high-born. Yet Jahangir was Mughal of India, lord of the Deccan, Kashmir, and Sindh. She was given as slave to Syed Afzal, who was well pleased, for she was fair of face and body. Many thought, so said the eunuch, that Krishnataya would slay herself, being of the Rajputs, where no woman may be slaves. Whether it was because she was a child, or for another reason, I do not know. But Krishnataya did not thrust a dagger into her throat. She became the property of Syed Afzal and said little, waxing thinner of face as dark circles came under her calf-like eyes. Syed Afzal tired of her swiftly. Those who eat much opium are not firm of purpose. He left her in the tents of the Uzbek harem, where she was dressed in the white silk trousers and cap of cloth of silver that the Uzbek women wear. Syed Afzal's eunuchs kept her from meeting with the Rajputs, who sometimes came to the camp of the Jahangir, fearing that they might do her harm. By the law of the Marwa, no high-born woman may be a slave to an enemy. Krishnataya had broken this law. She had not done as her ancestors, who dressed in their bridal clothes and followed the queen of the Rajputs into the funeral flames when Chittor fell to the enemy. Yet, so the eunuch whispered, she was but a child and might well fear the cold touch of death. Likewise, she ate opium, which kept her quiet and wrought upon her fancies. She had been partaking of it when Jani Beg visited her. He sat on the carpet by her and talked. He was a shrewd man, and her brain was aflame with the drug. "The farang is the shield on the arm of Sherzad Mir," he said. "He is like to a devil loosed from the Christian purgatory. Without him, Sherzad Mir would fare ill at our hands. He it was who took my son prisoner." She lifted up her soft eyes at this and plucked at the cap, which she wore instead of the veil of her people. "Yet he is his own man," continued Jani Beg. "He serves himself, none other. What reward he seeks I do not know, save that he has sworn to obtain certain trade concessions from the great Mughal. Jahangir will not see him so long as he fights with the rebels of Sherzad Mir." "Aye, Jani Beg, who was an Uzbek of low birth, dared to name Sherzad Mir, whose father and father's father ruled in Badakhshan, a rebel." "Mayhap," whispered Jani Beg, "Sir Wayan does not know that I am allied to the Mughal. If he knew this," Jani Beg smiled, "I might forget certain wrongs he has done me. Aye, and Jahangir might also forget, for the Mughal has counted the swords I lead. Say this to the farang." "How?" asked Krishnataya softly. The woman of the harem was listening behind the hangings of the tent and heard what passed. "It is in my mind," said Jani Beg, stroking his long beard, "to send a present to this farang dog. He is a merchant. And when did a merchant mislike the sight of gold? I will send a Persian sword with a gold hilt, certain rubies, and woven cloth of gold. I will send... He touched the long hair of the girl, and Krishnataya's cheeks grew red. You. The girl was silent, being afraid to speak. The Farang, went on Jani Beg, has a heart for fighting. But now there is a truce. I have willed it so. The men of Sherzad Mir think I am weak. He laughed and closed his hand on the girl's arm so her fingers became numb. As for you, be not so blind. I am the master of Badakhshan, a frontier of the Mughal. I can ask and receive much, and I seek much. He broke off to finger his beard again. Win me the Farang. Aye, win me Sir Wayand. I reward those who serve me. He unwound a long string of small pearls from his turban, where he had placed it in imitation of the Mughal fashion. This he laid about her throat and peered at her curiously. Can my words aid you, my lord? She said, feeling the pearls with a trembling hand. Aye, smiled Jani Beg. Put this thought in his head, and you will serve me well. How? His brows knit together in a swift frown. He plucked forth his dagger, and so quickly that she had no time to draw back, passed the blade before both her eyelids, which fluttered in alarm. So near came the blade that it touched the skin. So said the woman who saw. Are you a begum, a wife of a noble, to question my words? So, tell me in one word, will you do this thing faithfully? If not... His glance strayed to the dagger. Perhaps he would have liked to slay her, for the bloodlust was strong in him. I have seen Syed Afzal, who was his son, wring the neck of a white pigeon in order to feel the life quiver out through his fingers. Nevertheless, Jani Beg was an excellent soldier and full of guile. He had stirred the girl. Aye! She cried, looking wide-eyed at the dagger. I will sever the prop from him who seeks the throne of Badakhshan. It is well, he said indifferently and rose. Say what I have told you. He lowered his voice, so the woman behind the curtain did not hear. Presently he laughed in his bed. So, Krishnataya, soon six men will stand alone together, but before they part, they shall be four and two. This is what they said in the tent of Krishnataya that night. I did not hear of it until long after, until what Jani Beg had promised had come to pass, and 10,000 Uzbeks were storming the walls of Khanjut. It was a late watch in the afternoon, and I was drowsy. For the sun was warm on the stones of Khanjut, and no wind stirred in the dried leaves of the poplar trees that fringed the garden of the castle. Past the corner where I sat on my heels, one of the hillmen bore a jar. He had come from the cellars of the castle, and I suspected there was wine in the jar, so I rose and followed silently. Truly, I was a follower of the prophet, but my thirst was great. Where there was wine, I knew there would be drinking. I dogged the hillman past the battlements to the centre garden. He went down some steps, and I did likewise. I came full upon my lord, Sherzad Mir, and the Englishman, lying on some pleasant carpets under the trees. The bearer was just setting down the jar between them. Syed Afzal was nearby, lying at full length. Ho! Abdul Dost, cried Sherzad Mir, who had a quick eye. You have come like a dog at the smell of meat in the pot. Nay, do not leave us. Come, here is another bowl. Syed Afzal will not need his. He is rightly named the dreamer. He has taken opium until he is like a full-fed snake. I looked at the Uzbek. His head was slack on the carpet, crushing the white heron plume on the turban. His olive face was red, and he breathed heavily, while his slant eyes were glazed. They looked at me, but they seemed not to see. Truly, they were like those of a snake that smelled of musk and attar of rose. "Peace be unto you, my lord," I greeted Shirzad Mir and said. "I do not seek the wine." "A lie," cried Sir Wayan jovially, shaking his yellow head. "Come, let me fill your bowl, Abdul Dost." But I would not, as it would put me in the wrong. Then there came a soldier from the gate. "A message comes for the Lord Farang," he said after his salaam. We saw coming towards us under the trees a fat eunuch leading a slim girl by the wrist, and after them a white horse of excellent breed. The saddle cloths were silk, and there were jewels in the peak of the saddle. A scimitar with a gold hilt and some rich stuffs were on the saddle. I stared, and Sir Wayan sat up and looked at this curiously. The eunuch dropped to his knees and made the triple salaam, beating his head against the ground. The girl, who was veiled, fell also to her knees. "What means this?" asked Shirzad Mir in surprise. "It is a very small gift from the treasury of Jani Beg, O Lord of Barakshan, and descendant of the illustrious ancestors, O most munificent Shirzad Mohammed El Baba Hazret Mir," whined the eunuch. "Ho," muttered my master, who was not slow of wit. "Jani Beg sends me a horse and a sword, that I may mount and fight him. Then I will send back a silk rug of Persia and a spindle, for he seems more inclined to sit in the corner than to fight." "Thrice blessed, pardon," the eunuch chattered. "The gift is for the Farang. It is for the illustrious stranger in our country. Jani Beg does not wish to be thought an ungenerous foe." "For me?" Sir Wayan looked from the eunuch to the girl and then to the horse. "Aye. May it be pleasant in the sight of your nobleness. Truly the woman is of the Rajputs, and surpassingly fair. I have guarded her with zeal. There is not a blemish on her. Please! Sir Wayan's cheeks became red. Shirzad Mir began to laugh. "Jani Beg honours you with a wife," he chuckled. "Now that you have taken Kanjut, he sends you a slave." I did not laugh, considering what this might mean. The eunuch plucked the veil from the woman's face, enough to show her beauty. "It is a slave," he boasted, "and such a slave. I will take good care of her for my lord the Farang. I like not the service of Jani Beg." He caught sight of Syed Afzal and gasped. The poet's heavy eyes had turned slowly to the girl, and he was twisting his thin black beard. The miserable guardian of the harem quivered in fright like a fish caught between two nets. But Sir Wayand looked long into the dark eyes that sought his and fell silent. "She is not ill to look upon," commented Shirzad Mir gravely. "Jani Beg is unusually thoughtful. I would have said this woman was chosen by Syed Afzal if we had not had him prisoner for the last moon." "A royal gift to one who deserves it, lord," whined the eunuch, who thought this at least was safe to say. "And are you also a royal present?" demanded my master quickly. "Nay," the fat one salaamed, "I am but dirt from a dunghill." "Do we deserve dirt?" "Nay," the unhappy man wriggled, fearing that his death was near, but voluble after his kind. "I meant that I was but a servant who had come to the Garden of Paradise from a swine pen." "From the Uzbeks?" The merry eyes of Shirzad Mir twinkled. The eunuch lifted his head long enough to see that Syed Afzal was listening. "Have mercy, lord. What was in my mind was that your presence has made me blessed, like one who comes from darkness to light. Now that I know the gift of the illustrious Jani Beg has been well received, enough! Shirzad Mur frowned. He whispered to Sir Wayand that a eunuch was a breeder of trouble. Get to your feet, O dunghill that came to the Garden of Paradise. Abdul Dost, go to the battlements and take up the first bow that comes to hand. This dog may now begin to run out of the gate. Bring him down with an arrow, if you can, from the wall. If not, he goes free. He waved his hand, and the fat man galloped off like a frightened elephant. I also made speed to the wall. I would have been well content to plant a shaft into his haunches. But when I gained the battlement, he was far below me. He had rolled from the winding road down the slope of the cliff. His bones must have been well shaken. Still, he saved his life. So it happened that when I reached the spot under the trees again, all were gone but the soldier, who was taking a drink from the jar. I upbraided him well, for I had remembered the jar and was still thirsty. He said the girl had fallen to weeping, and Sir Wayand had softened to her tears when she cried that it would be her death to send her back to Jani Beg. The Farang had offered her a room in his residence. The horse and the sword he had presented to Shirzad Mur, who had taken them readily, saying that he would ride the one and cut off Jani Beg's head with the other. But I was not content, knowing it was not wanted that a woman of the Rajputs should consent to be a slave. I dismissed the man. There was still some wine in the jar, and no one was looking. So the girl of the Rajputs came to Kanjut. But I knew that any gift from Jani Beg was not meant for our happiness. I sent the soldier who had drunk from my jar of wine, Bihor Jan, a long-legged Afghan with nimble wits and a quick ear, to Sir Wayand to serve as a guard for the woman. Thus, Bihor Jan would tell me what she did. A day passed, and then another. I sought out Bihor Jan, who was squatting on the stone of the entrance hall of the castle. I asked him what had passed between the woman and Sir Wayand. Eh? The Afghan spat and looked about him. The Farang has seen her but once. It was when she carried his curry and wine from the kitchen to his room. What did Sir Wayand? The Farang? What you or I would have done, Abdul Dost. He ate of the food. And the woman? She said in a soft voice, so I could scarcely hear, although the door was open, that she was his slave. She asked why he turned his face from her service. What said he? He became red and said that in his country there were no slaves. He did not wish her to wait upon him. That was well so far, but before long the Afghan came to my room, an alcove opening from that of Shirzad Mur, and greeted me. I saw from his dark face that he had news on his stomach, and I invited him to kneel and eat, as I was doing. He did this readily, scooping up in his dirty fingers some choice sugared fruit that I had selected for myself. This day, he grunted between mouthfuls, Krishnataya seated herself by the embrasure of the Farang's room and waited for his arrival. When he came, she salaamed and cried that her heart was troubled with loneliness. He took up the bowl of jelly for which I had been about to reach. Now that it was too late, I pretended I did not want the jelly. She was lonely with desire for her own country. She asked the Farang if he would help her get back to Rajputana. Then he questioned her concerning the Rajputs and their alliance with the Mughal. I could not hear what they said after that, though I sat with my back to the door. But the name of Jani Beg was spoken. From this time forth, I sometimes saw Sir Wayand walking about the garden with the woman. They talked much, for she was trying to teach him the language of the Rajputs, and he was anxious to learn. How is a man to scent danger in the perfume of a woman's robes or the quick glance of her dark eyes? Once, when they had been sitting under the bare pomegranates, I watched her walk back to the castle. She carried herself proudly, for all she was a slave. "Hey, Sir Wayand," I said curiously. "She is fair. Jarni Beg sent you a princely gift." "Nay, I do not know what to do with her, Abdul Dost," he said quickly. "Jarni Beg will not take her back, nor will her own people, now that she is under the cloud of dishonour." "Why not sell her? It would not be hard to find a buyer." "That I will not do, unless it should be her will." Truly, the Farang had a strange nature. The woman embarrassed him. He would not let her serve him and wait on him, yet he would not take a round sum for her, or even sell the fine necklace she wore. Then I saw he was frowning, looking out under the trees. I also looked and noticed that the Uzbek prince had stopped her. Syed Afzal was leaning close and whispering, fingering the pearls at her throat, for he knew not we watched. She listened to what the Uzbek said, but when the poet laid a hand on her arm, she freed herself and ran off into the building. "Once," I whispered, wishing to test the Farang, "Syed Afzal owned Krishna Tyre. He it was who took her for a slave against the law of her people. Perhaps she loves Syed Afzal." He looked at me keenly. "Think you so, Abdul Dost?" "Aye," I lied. "Why else did she not slay herself, as is the custom of her people, after an injury that they cannot avenge?" He fell silent, but the look he cast after the languid figure of the Uzbek was not friendly. I thought of the verses in the Quran which say that fire, once kindled, is difficult to put out. Why had the Farang named the girl Roseface if his heart had not wanted her? For the moment, all thought of the girl was driven from my mind. Bihor Jan approached and said that Sherzad Mir demanded my presence. A rider had been sighted in the plain before the citadel. He had made signs to our outposts that he was on a mission of peace and would speak to those in Kanjut. It was Sherzad Mir's order that I should mount and ride to meet this man. I donned a clean tunic over my mail and wrapped a white turban about my head. I chose a good sword and a sightly horse. The others watched from the wall as I passed down the cliff road, over the drawbridge, and neared the rider. Then I saw it was Rajaman Singh, one of the highest emirs of the Mughal court and a general to Jahangir himself, also leader of the Rajputs. He was very elegantly dressed, with a jeweled sword stuck through his girdle and a large single diamond on the front of his turban. He rode excellently well and seemed quite fearless. He had a neatly combed black beard divided on each side of his chin, and his glance was that of a man of many followers. Rajaman Singh greeted me in soft Persian, somewhat contemptuously. I did not dismount, despite his high rank, for I considered myself the emissary of Sherzad Mir. Besides, I was the older man. I lifted my hand to my forehead and beat my head very slightly. I waited for him to speak my own tongue, as I knew not Persian, and this he presently did. "Have you learnt manners among the dogs, soldier?" he cried harshly. "That you do not know the courtesy due an emir of the Mughal?" "Nay, Rajaman Singh," I made response. "I was bred in the camp of the great Mughal Akbar, on whom be peace. There I also was given rank, on the battlefield." His horse was moving restlessly, but he did not sit the less straight for this. He was a splendid horseman and a soldier among many. It surprised me that he had come alone to Kanjut. Later, however, the thought came to me that he was but just arrived from Jahangir's army and sought to look upon the strength of the fortress. "The greater shame to be a rebel now," he cried with all the intolerance of his race. "Nay," I said again, "Shirzad Mir has been faithful to the Mughals before the barbarian Uzbeks set foot in Badakhshan." He merely grunted, fingering his beard disdainfully. "Then take me to Shirzad Mir," he ordered, "since I come on a mission of truce." Shirzad Mir bade me bring the message to him, not the messenger. "Dog!" he gritted his white teeth. "Am I one to exchange words with such as you? Tell your master that Jani Beg would speak with him. The Uzbek Emir will ride to the spot when the sun is at noon. He and I will be alone. Let Shirzad Mir come hither with one man, no more. We seek a parley, not war, at present. Let him come or not, as it suits him. I care not." Wheeling his mount, the Raj put spurred away, raising a cloud of dust. He was a fearless man, although merciless. It is the wisdom of God that no man can know the fate in store for him. It was our fate that we should not see the black cloud of peril rising over Khanjut, or the toils of the snare that closed about Shirzad Mir. My men gambled and ate and were happy, thinking of insulting things to say to the Uzbek patrols that sometimes neared our walls. And I also would have been happy, but for Krishna Tyre. I could not linger, yet I whispered a word of caution to Bihor Jan as I rode off with Shirzad Mir to meet our foes. If the Rajput had not been with Jani Beg, we would not have gone. But the Rajput was a man of his word, as was Shirzad Mir. I was proud of my lord as he cantered to meet the other two. Jani Beg, who was there first, thought to impose a hardship on my lord by dismounting and sitting upon his cloak. Thus, he hoped to make Shirzad Mir approach him on foot as an inferior in rank. Rajaman Singh, impatient of such pettishness, kept to his horse. But my master saw through the artifice. He cantered straight up to the sitting Uzbek, and he did not dismount. He reined in his horse only when its hooves were fair upon the silk cloak of Jani Beg. In spite of himself, the Uzbek drew back and scowled. I turned my head to hide a smile, and I saw the Rajput's beard twitch. He and Shirzad Mir greeted each other briefly. Jani Beg was made to look ridiculous, squatting beneath our horse's legs. So he rose and mounted, and I saw the pulse in his forehead beating. I, being inferior in rank, made the salaam from the saddle, which is not customary, yet I followed the example of Shirzad Mir, and he cast me an approving glance. "We have come, Shirzad Mir," said Rajaman Singh, "to arrange certain terms between the Uzbeks and the rebels. Jani Beg desires to treat for the ransom of his son." The Uzbek chieftain looked darkly at the general of the Mughal. He would have liked better to play with words, but the Rajput was impatient. "We," Jani Beg waved his lean hand towards the Rajput, "will offer you a continuation of the truce you desire if you will release Syed Afzal and his personal followers." Again, Shirzad Mir smiled. "Is the truce of our seeking, Jani Beg? Nay, you have chosen it. For my part, I shall not rest from fighting until Badakhshan is free from invaders." "Then you will continue to rebel against the Mughal?" "Nay, Badakhshan is part of the Mughals' empire. I fight only with the Uzbeks. Yet I and my men are serving the Mughal, and you see Rajaman Singh." Shirzad Mir did not smile this time. "Let the Rajput give heed to this," he said slowly. Lies have been spoken against me in court, and I have taken up the sword of vengeance against the author of those lies. My quarrel is not with the mogul. When the fighting is ended, he shall receive my allegiance." They were bold words, spoken by an outlawed chieftain, with only a handful of hillmen opposed to the Uzbek army, which possessed powder and artillery and was strengthened by a force of the invincible Rajput cavalry. I held my head high with pride and listened keenly. Jani Beg began to speak words of another colour. "You have an ally, Sherzad Mir," he observed shrewdly. "A Faraon. You owe him much. Tell him, as ransom for my son, I will procure his pardon from the Jahangir, who is at Kabul, and also an audience with the Jahangir. Thus, he may obtain the trade rights he seeks for England." Truly, the guile of the Uzbek was great. If Sherzad Mir should refuse this offer, it must offend Sir Wayand. Should my master keep the offer secret from the Farang, Jani Beg would find means of getting the news to the Englishman's ears. Yet both Sherzad Mir and I knew that it would not do to give up Syed Afzal for a promise of Jani Beg. Sherzad Mir fingered his beard thoughtfully. Then he turned to the elegant figure of the Rajput. "Do you also pledge your word, Rajaman Singh?" he asked courteously. "That this privilege will be granted the Farang and that he will not be harmed?" Jani Beg had spoken cleverly. He knew that we could ill afford to lose the services of Sir Wayand, but the Rajput cherished the righteousness of his spoken pledge as a woman guards her honour. "Nay," he cried, "this is not my affair. I have no authority to give a promise for the Jahangir. Settle the matter between yourselves." I pricked up my ears at that, for it sounded as if the Rajput were not over fond of the Uzbek. Jani Beg had hinted that the two were his brothers. The Uzbek frowned slightly, then his brow cleared. He smiled with thick lips. "I will give up the bulk as ransom for my son." When he said that, I saw the Rajput's brows twitch in involuntary surprise. The thought came to me that Jani Beg was offering more than he intended to pay. Sherzad Mir was not one to be caught by such trap. "Nay," he said pleasantly, "does a falcon give up its perch to strut on the ground where are many wolves? Keep bulk, if you can." By now, Rajaman Singh was waxing restless. His handsome face was petulant. "Shiva! And Shiva," he cried. "Name the rebel a price, Jani Beg. I am thirsty. Give him a camel load of gold." He lifted some grains of brown powder from a jeweled box that hung at his throat and placed them on his tongue. Jani Beg thought swiftly. He had no wish to exasperate the Rajput. 2 lakhs of rupee and 20 horses of Arabia," he began, when Sherzad Mir broke in. "We have no need of such." He turned to the Rajput. "Give me 12 donkeys heavily loaded with powder and 2 others bearing camel swivels. Also, 24 good matchlocks and as many braces of Turkish pistols, and you shall have Syed Afzal." The Rajput seemed about to refuse. Powder and cannon, even such small pieces of brass, were beyond price in Badakhshan, and I judged that the swivels belonged to Rajaman Singh himself. Sir Wayand had said that there were many in the Mughals' army, although the Uzbeks had them not. But Jani Beg cast him a glance. "It is well," the Uzbek said swiftly. 2 days we must have to make ready things. We will bring them to this place when the sun is at the same hour. The beasts of burden must be driven by 6 unarmed men on foot," bargained Sherzad Mir. "Aye, and Syed Afzal must be unharmed." Not a scratch shall be on his skin. He shall be whole, although probably drunk, as is his custom. So it was agreed. Jarni Beg's party, including the beasts with the ransom, would ride to this spot in the plain. We would come forth to meet them. Then, while we still held Syed Afzal and any who came to attend him, the men who drove the beasts would retire to the Uzbek lines. Then we would join Jarni Beg's party and deliver the prisoner. They would ride away, leaving us the animals with their valuable burden. I will come alone with Rajaman Singh, added Jarni Beg, and you will bring only Sir Wayand. Sherzad Mir was surprised and hesitated. I was angered that I should not accompany my lord, as was my hereditary right, but Jarni Beg said smoothly that both he and the Rajput desired to look upon the Farang, and Sherzad Mir assented, saying only that in the case Syed Afzal was drunk, I should be allowed to escort his litter down to the meeting place and should remain 10 spear lengths distant. He asked this because it was my right by custom. Likewise, and he looked at the Rajput, not at Jarni Beg, this thing shall be done in peace, and the curse of God be on the man who sets hand to sword. I pledge this for myself and those with me. Then I noted that Jarni Beg spoke swiftly before the Rajput. Aye, we trust you, Sherzad Mir. Whereupon both wheeled their horses and made off. Not, however, before I saw a gleam of satisfaction on the Uzbek's hawk-like face. For some secret reason, he was well pleased with the bargain. The thought came to me that he was using the Rajput's honour as a shield and that Sherzad Mir had too readily got what he asked. Jarni Beg glanced backwards shrewdly over his shoulder as he rode, but the Rajput, who was a fearless man, looked neither right nor left. In spite of my foreboding, my heart swelled at the thought of possessing the powder and the brass cannon. "Hey, Abdul Dost," cried my lord. "We have strengthened mighty Kanjut at the price of an opium-guzzling animal." And think as I would, the bargain seemed safe to me, notwithstanding my distrust of Jarni Beg. Sir Wayand and my lord would be alone with Jarni Beg and the Rajput. If swords should, by chance, be drawn, the odds would be even, and I should not be far distant. Men have said I am an excellent hand with the scimitar. And likewise, there was the honour of Rajaman Singh, who would not draw the first sword, although in a quarrel he would be forced to side with Jarni Beg. As for Syed Afzal, he could not lift a weapon. A change had come upon Sir Wayand. He fell moody, and he seemed to avoid Sherzad Mir and me. Jan reported to me that he had talked long and quietly with Krishna Taya, and at other times had walked by himself on the ramparts. This was not wanted, for when himself, the Farang was a merry man, although not fond of words. Once I had asked him if the devil of illness had gripped him. "I know not what devil it is, Abdul Dost," he made reply. "There is a matter lies heavily on my mind. It is not always easy to settle what is right and what is wrong." He spoke with seeming frankness, yet the words had a strange ring. He turned on me suddenly. "Is it true, Abdul Dost, that Jarni Beg offered to give me safe conduct to the Jahangir?" I started, for how could the news have come to him? "The words of Jarni Beg are as false as a wolf's whine," I replied after thinking up on the matter. "If he made an offer, he did not mean to keep it. When Sherzad Mir gives his pledge of friendship, he will abide by it." "I doubt it not," he muttered. "It is long since I came to India, yet I am no nearer to the heir of the Jahangir than at first. I cannot forget my mission." He broke off and walked away. Then came Bihor Jan, on the Farang's footsteps and whispered to me in passing. Roseface is beloved. Oh, I was surprised. The Farang? I know not. I have watched Syed Afzal. The poet's eyes follow the girl when she walks by, and there is a gleam in them. He plays to her on a guitar, lying at her side, and strokes the pearls of the necklace she wears. Sir Wayand likes it not. Why should he waste thought on the woman? Perhaps Bihor Jan would have liked the necklace of pearls for himself. For many hours I considered the matter. The Farang had known of the offer of Jani Beg, yet neither Shirzad Mir nor I had spoken of it. God has strengthened the walls of the Khanjut. I did not think any spy of the Uzbeks had climbed within them, so the thought came to me that someone had known the offer was to be made. Perhaps Syed Afzal, perhaps Krishna Taya, perhaps Sir Wayand. Here was a horse that would require grooming. I went to Sir Wayand and spoke what was on my mind. How was I to know that I had blundered? The girl distresses you, Sir Wayand, I said bluntly. Why not give her to Syed Afzal? Then she will have a master. It is true that you do not desire a slave. Death's life, Abdul Dost, he swore. It is true. He fell silent. That might be best. Krishna Taya must be cared for. I think Syed Afzal is fond of her. She is no more than a child. I did not smile. So it came to pass that Krishna Taya consented to serve Syed Afzal. She gathered up her belongings in a bundle and went to the dwelling of the Uzbek prince. Yet that night, I found Sir Wayand walking moodily the length of her room, which was now as empty as a year-old nightingale's nest. I think it was the first time he had been there. The room smelt of attar of rose, after the manner of a woman's apartment. I did not speak to him, for his face was not pleasant. Nevertheless, I considered it well. Now that Krishna Taya was with the Uzbek, she would not bother Sir Wayand, nor would it be so easy for her to talk with him. I kept thinking of the meeting with Jani Beg, which was to take place the next day. There seemed to be no danger. The plain before the castle was bare, and no followers of the Uzbeks could approach the spot without being seen from the battlements. Since I was old enough to shoot an arrow at a stag, it was my task to safeguard the person of Shirzad Mir. I wearied my brains upon the matter of the meeting, without result. God had willed that I should not foresee what was to come to pass. Still, one thing I did see. The demon of unrest kept me awake that night, and I walked the edge of the garden, past the stables and the door of Shirzad Mir. It was a still night, and the splendour of the stars beat down on Khanjut. I hearkened to the challenge of the sentries and the stamp of a hoof amongst the horses. Then I heard voices among the bare trees of the garden. For the space milk takes to boil, I waited, holding my breath. Then I stepped softly nearer the voices. The Farang and Krishna Taya were talking together. By staring for a long time, I made out their forms against the grey stretch of a wall. They stood close and whispered. I heard Krishna Taya laugh, and it sounded like the low murmur of a rivulet. Sir Wayan's voice came to me harsh and urgent. "You must not do this thing, Roseface," he said. Again I held my breath, but her whispered words were not clear. His reply was spoken in swift, broken phrases of a man who is troubled by a great trouble. Then I caught the name of Shirzad Mir and bristled. "You will come and be at my side when the time is near," she whispered wistfully after the fashion of a woman who has bound a man by the silken cord of love. I, Roseface. Sir Wayan had made a decision, and it had cost him much. For a space, the two forms by the grey wall merged, and the thought came to me that he had kissed her before she sped away through the garden. Thereupon, he turned and went to his own quarters. Blah! If I had had her slim throat between my hands, I should have strangled her by the rope of pearls, for there had been pain and unwillingness in the voice of Sir Wayand, and this betokened ill to my lord. This is the thing I told Shehrazad Mir after the dawn prayer, and he laughed in his bed. Of the servant who brings me food, of my foster brother, I might believe evil, Abdul Dost, he responded, but not of Sir Wayand. Yet I marked a flush in the cheeks of the Rajput maiden that morning and heard her sing in the apartment of Syed Afzal for the first time since she had come to Kanjut. What was I to do? Noon came, the hour we were to ride to meet Jani Beg. Bihor Jan told me with a grin that Syed Afzal was wrapped in opium dreams and lay like a stricken pig. So as this was my task, I had a litter board, and the Afghan and I placed Syed Afzal upon it. Then Krishnataya, who watched, came and said that she was also to ride on the litter, as she would go with the Uzbek. I would not consent. I smelled evil in this, as a hound smells the trace of a hare. Striding to Shehrazad Mir, I demanded angrily that Krishnataya should not go. Sir Wayand, who was listening, spoke curtly. It shall be as she wishes, Abdul Dost. Did not your master promise that any attendant of the prince might accompany her? Shehrazad Mir made me a careless sign to be about my business. He was not one to suspect treachery, yet the Farang's eye had not met mine as he spoke. As I had been ordered, I did. I placed a cashmere shawl over the frame of the litter where Krishnataya sat by Syed Afzal's head. This was to guard the two from the sun and from curious eyes. When it was time, I summoned Bihor Jan with seven others and accompanied them as they bore the litter down from the castle, across the courtyard and down the winding road to the plain. Out over the drawbridge the litter passed. When we reached the spot of the meeting, I bade the eight set down their burden. When Shehrazad Mir and Sir Wayand rode from the castle gate, I ordered the bearers to retire to Kanjut. I sat moodily on the horse, watching the languid movements of Syed Afzal's slippered feet, all that I could see of the poet, and thought blackly upon the danger to Shehrazad Mir. When he and the Farang gained my side, Shehrazad Mir bade me withdraw 10 spear lengths towards Kanjut. This I did, and when I turned at my new station, the Uzbek party came in view. Rajaman Singh, in all his finery, was leading with Jani Beg, who sat his horse in grim silence. Behind them came the cavalcade of donkey, ushered by 4 or 5 miserable slaves. The little beasts carried weighty packs. I caught the glitter of brass upon one. A cloud of dust rose about them and hung in the air, for there was no wind. The jewels gleamed in the turban of the Rajput, and he laughed more than once, but Jani Beg did not laugh. Nearer they came, and nearer. I could see the sweat on the donkey's shoulders and marked the outline of the powder boxes under the pack. God has given me keen sight, and all that followed I saw clearly. I saw the Rajput halt the donkey men and order them off with a contemptuous gesture, and Jani Beg and Sir Wayand peer in the packs as if to make sure what they held. I saw the beasts begin to nuzzle for grass to crop, and Rajaman Singh ride up to the waiting too. By now, the donkey men were a good bowshot distant. Then all four of the riders dismounted, watching one another. I leaned upon the peak of my saddle and swallowed hard, for my throat was dry. The dust settled down. I marked a pigeon wheeling overhead. There was a great stillness on the plain of Barakshan. Khanjut was far, far distant, and Shirzad Mir stood with the three men at his side, all being armed. The Rajput's white teeth showed in a laugh. This time, Jani Beg smiled. He was in a cordial mood, for he advanced to Shirzad Mir and made a low salaam. Afar off, I heard a holy man cry to prayers. Then suddenly, I saw the lean arms of Jani Beg spring forth and grip Shirzad Mir. Like a swift snake, he twined about my master, holding Shirzad Mir's arms to his sides. "Strike him!" cried Jani Beg, "in the throat above his armour." It was to the Farang that he had said this. The eyes of Rajaman Singh widened in astonishment. Sir Wayan's muscles quivered, but he did not move to aid the treacherous Uzbek. Instead, he stepped towards the litter. The thing was clear to me. Jani Beg thought that the Farang would slay Mir, as he had cried for him to do. Something had gone amiss with Beg's plan, for neither Sir Wayand nor the Rajput moved. Aye, the Rajput was a man of high honour. Shirzad Mir strained at the Uzbek's grip. Jani Beg's face grew dark with rage. I dug my spurs deep into the side of my horse. He sprang forwards, a leap that would have unsettled another rider, and I bore down on Jani Beg. Hot was my heart with anger at the sight of Shirzad Mir helpless among the three. I had lifted my scimitar to strike down Jani Beg. I had galloped within arm's reach, and there I reined in my mount on its haunches. Aye, I drew rein at the sight of the three, for the Rajput and Sir Wayand and Shirzad Mir were staring not at Jani Beg, but at the litter, and on the three faces was the mark of amazement and horror. I also looked down at the litter. Krishnateya had pushed back the shawl. She sat upon her knees, with the head of Syed Afzal on her lap. The sleek face of Syed Afzal was red, and his eyes glazed, as in the opium trance. He lay still, very still. From his gaping mouth hung the end of a string of pearls. The pearls looked like the tip of a necklace. I had seen them before. I looked from the mottled face that glared up at me to the neck of the maiden. The necklace had gone from the throat of Krishnateya. She sat very straight on the litter, and there was a smile on her childlike face. "Here is Syed Afzal Jani Beg," she said softly, "whole and without a scratch upon his skin." The Uzbek looked from her to the head of the dead man on her knee, and his mouth opened slowly. His arms that were about Shirzad Mir dropped to his sides, and he tried vainly to swallow, like one who has the palsy. I heard my lord mutter in his bed, "By the 90 holy names of God, I knew naught of this." Yet I heeded not. The pigeon overhead fluttered away. Then hate leapt into the evil face of Jani Beg as a flame sears paper. "Wench! Child of sin! Traitorous!" he gasped, and then choked to silence. "Nay," she spoke calmly, "what I promised you has been done. I have cut the prop from him who would usurp the throne of Barakshan." So great was the rage of Jani Beg that his hand trembled so he could scarcely grip the dagger in his girdle. He raised the dagger with one hand. The other he twisted in the hair of the maiden, who looked up at him and smiled. "It is well," I heard her whisper. I have made clean the honour of the Rajput. Neither I nor Shirzad Mir would have checked Jani Beg in the slaying of Krishna Taya, but the dagger did not reach her slender throat. Sir Wayan had gripped the hand that held the weapon. For the space of a long breath, the eyes of the Farang and the Uzbek met and held. The arms of the two quivered and strained. The lips of the Farang were closed in a tight line. Then Jani Beg spoke in level words. Every soul in Kanjut shall die if this woman is not slain. Sir Wayan did not relax his grip. She avenged the wrong that was done her. His voice was curiously strained. He turned his face to the Rajput. Krishnataya needs the protection of the Rajputs. Rajaman Singh sighed and twisted a strand of his curly beard. His glance went from the end of the pearl necklace that had strangled Syed Afzal to the woman. Come, he said at length, curtly. He took the girl and lifted her to the back of his horse behind the saddle. We knew, and Jani Beg knew, that Krishnataya was now safe under the sword of the Rajput. Many things were in my mind as I drove the donkeys up to Kanjut, following after Shirzad Mir and Sir Wayan. I thought of the reckless honour of Shirzad Mir that had let Jani Beg depart unharmed because of his pledge. I wondered whether one of us would live to tell of the Uzbek storm that would be launched upon us because Sir Wayand had guarded the life of Krishnataya when Jani Beg lusted for vengeance. But among these thoughts, one was uppermost. It was a verse from the Quran. Who knows what is in the heart of a woman?
That was Rose Face by H.A. Lamb, narrated by Lewis Morgan. While the content is quite different, I can't help comparing this story to The Spirit of France, as narrated for us by Josie Babin. As with that story, Lewis had some remarkable language hurdles to clear, and a surprisingly strong, considering the era, female character to contend with. I congratulate his Herculean contribution. Lamb's background as a historian is also clearly at work here. The rich texture someone like Jack London brings to a Canadian landscape, Lamb matches till you can almost smell the hashish and the dust of life in 17th century Badakhshan. I hope you found it similarly immersive. Drop by the site at protectingprojectpulp.com and leave a comment on the episode post, or join the conversation in the District of Wonders forum linked from the site. Let us know what you thought of the story or Lewis's narration. And while you're there, don't forget to subscribe to the show via iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Just click the subscribe link. Personally, I find narrating these stories and sharing them with the District of Wonders community tremendously satisfying. Drop us an email at protectingprojectpulp@gmail.com. We're critically short of narrators, and we'd love to hear what you sound like. Thanks for listening from everyone here at PPP. Our assistant editor, Fred Heimbaugh, our sound engineer, Tom O'Dwyer, our producer, Tony C. Smith, and from me, your host, Simon Hildebrandt. We hope you'll join us next time for episode 57, where we'll bring you The Shadow on the Doorstep by James Blaylock. So remember that it is the wisdom of God that no man can know the fate in store for him. And have a great week.
This presentation has been brought to you by the District of Wonders Network, dedicated to podcasting the finest genre fiction. You can learn more about the District of Wonders and their many literary productions at their website, www.districtofwonders.com. Thank you for listening.